If you're hearing this, it means that you're subscribed to the public podcast feed and only getting part of the conversation. If you'd like to listen to the full episode and gain exclusive access to the first 100 episode archive, consider becoming part of the pack over at patreon.com/howlinthewilderness. Welcome to the Howl in the Wilderness podcast. I'm your host, Brian James. Howl in the Wilderness features deep and insightful conversations with renegade artists, philosophers, psychologists, and spiritual teachers who are working on the edge of dominant culture to recover and revive soul in people in the planet. On this episode, I speak with Glenn Slater about his new book, Jung vs. Borg, Finding the Deeply Human in a Post-Human Age. I feel that this is the most relevant and important psychological text for our current time, but you don't have to take it from me. Noted trauma psychologist Donald Kahlshed writes, "Glenn Slater's brilliant and passionate analysis of online culture and its insidious seductions of hyper-reality, virtual companions, and cyber-presences, all run by artificial intelligence, opens up that imagination in ways that are both terrifying and illuminating. To become conscious of these dehumanizing forces in our midst and how to combat their dissociative effects on the inner life of the soul should be a major focus of all depth psychological training in the 21st century." I couldn't agree more, and I'm grateful to Glenn for spending so much time with me to help unpack some of the key themes of his book. Glenn studied psychology and comparative religion at the University of Sydney before coming to the U.S. in 1992 for doctoral work in clinical psychology. He has been teaching at Pacifica for over 20 years and is currently the associate chair of the Jungian and Archetypal Studies specialization. He also teaches in the Mythological Studies program. Glenn's publications have appeared in a number of Jungian journals and essay collections, and he edited and introduced the third volume of James Hillman's Uniform Edition, Senex and Puer, as well as a collection of faculty writings, Varieties of Mythic Experience, Essays on Religion, Psyche, and Culture. Beyond his work in Jungian and archetypal psychology, he writes on psyche and film, as well as the psychology of technology. Glenn lectures internationally in all these areas of interest. As usual, this episode is made possible through the generous support of the Howl in the Wilderness Patreon community. If you'd like to enjoy early release of full ad-free episodes and have access to the archive of the first 100 episodes of the podcast, please consider becoming part of the pack over at patreon.com/howlinthewilderness. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. Glenn Slater, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast.
Good to be with you.
Yeah, I've wanted to speak to you for a while. I think the first time I encountered your writing was in the introduction to James Hillman's Senex and Puer collection. It's fantastic. I've actually kind of copied it, and I send it to clients sometimes when we start to get into the archetype of Senex Puer, because I think it's such a clear and succinct summary of some of the ideas that Hillman presents.
It's fantastic. That's definitely the case. I think with a lot of people who discover Hillman, you know, they focus on revisioning psychology and then some of his later works, but I think in the Senex and Puer essays, you see the sort of underpinnings of his thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's become such a relevant archetype as I kind of age into my middle age and beyond, and work with more men who are at kind of a midlife point. I've come to see the Senex Puer archetype as being really kind of central to that midlife passage for especially men. That's who I mostly work with.
Yeah, and I think the themes, you know, the shorthand for Puer and Senex, new and old, basically. And so we're always juggling with that relationship. And in the work I've been doing lately around technology, that's true too, because it seems as though we've entered into the cult of the new and really have gotten very good at disregarding our relationship with the past. But, you know, as we know from depth psychology, the past is still alive within us. So, you know, that disconnection causes difficulties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm reminded of a quote. I think it was maybe Faulkner who said, the past is not even past. Mm. You know, like it's still with us. It's still living through us.
You know? Right, right. Yep.
Well, we are here to talk about technology and your most recent book, Jung versus Borg, Finding the Deeply Human in a Post-Human Age. And I have to say, I'm so glad that you wrote this book at this time. As conversations around AI have become more prevalent in the culture, online media, one thing I've seen or I felt was left out is its impact on the human soul. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really happy that you were the person to write this book because you have the same, I think you write from a similar place as Hillman. The book is puts across a strong case, I would say arguing for soul and maybe arguing against its one-sided vision of the future and the, what you call the post-humanist fantasy or vision or dream. And so I really enjoy that. And I think you make a really strong case and I feel the kind of the fire in the writing. So I'm assuming that you felt quite strongly about this. Like it seems like you were driven to write this book and to put so much care into it. I mean, it's a very kind of dense book. There's a lot of ideas in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the thing about technology is that it's with us. We live in a technological world. It's not going to go away. But the problem from the psychological perspective is that the shadow side tends to get left on the shelf. And modern technology has always cast long, deep shadows. This is somewhat obvious. But I think in the last 20 years or so, as we've really moved into the digital age and brought it into our daily life with email and smartphones and so forth, there was a long period of a kind of idealization of this world that you remember back at the early days of the internet. The internet was going to spread democracy around the world. It was going to pull us together in terms of our sensibilities and create deeper community. It was going to disseminate information so everyone would have access to things. And I think really it's in the last only 5 or 6 years that people have started to wake up to, well, there's another side to this digital world, the side of misinformation and disinformation, the side of tribalism, the kind of post-fact world, so-called, that we now live in, the social isolation that has ironically accompanied the social media, and so on. And now at the punctuation mark is the questions that AI is bringing in. And all of a sudden, people saying, well, wait a minute, you know, can we simply innovate in a blind, automatic fashion, pretending that the free market and so forth will take care of it? And I suppose what's at the heart of my book is saying, no, we can't afford to do that anymore. We have to be technological with more consciousness. And for me, as a depth psychologist, that means taking the unconscious into account. So that's essentially what I think I'm up to with the book.
Mm. Yeah, there's definitely the feeling that we've moved from a kind of utopian dream of technology into a living nightmare. And there's a strange move being made to address some of the harmful effects of technology on the individual psyche with technology itself, with things like AI therapy and mental health apps and things like that. And I don't know, isn't there some old saying about trying to use the same tool to fix the problem, you know, the tool that created the problem or something like that? It mm-hmm. just feels a bit like that, like kind of a horrible Ouroboros. In the book, you write, a vast psychosocial failure is becoming the most pronounced feature of the digital age, poised to surpass climate disruption as the most pressing crisis of the 21st century. Now, I thought that would be a good place to start with the kind of state of the disunion. Where do you see us? Where do you see where we're at psychologically right now? Like, what are some of the impacts that are coming to light?
Yeah, well, I thought that would be a way into the topic that people could grasp, because we've lived with climate, the phenomenon of climate disruption, for some time, and we are well aware of the implications of that. And so I'm putting forth the idea that there is also, to borrow the phrase from Gregory Bateson, an ecology of mind, which is a notion that goes very well with the sort of Jungian idea of the psyche, which is the psyche isn't simply this this tabula rasa that we fill in with experiences and so forth. It itself has an organizational structure. It has an archetypal basis. The relationship between the conscious and unconscious has certain dynamics and so on, so that we can't simply take certain one-sided conscious attitudes and not expect there to be some disruption. So I'm putting forth the idea that our immersion in the digital world, the degree to which our lives have moved online in many respects, the degree to which, for young people in particular, their sense of their personality is in their social media activity more than it is in this life, the offline world, as they call it. But there's some extremely troubling things going on there. There's now well-documented skyrocketing levels of depression and anxiety among digital natives. There's the disinformation I've already mentioned. In other words, the ecology of the psychic space that we're in seems to have be coming into a major disruption. So that's more or less the platform for the discussion in the book.
Mm-hmm. One of the other symptoms you point to is dissociation. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Well, you know, if I can just bring in the post-human for a second, because I think one of the most prominent ideas that's very influential in tech circles is that we're going to unite more and more with technology, that our minds and, you know, human intelligence and artificial intelligence are going to somehow be brought together with brain computer interfaces and so forth, and I feel that this post-human fantasy is contrasted with what I call the deeply human, which would be where we're connected to our instinctual lives, to our ancestral memories, to, you know, for short, I use the idea of the sort of vertical axis of awareness. You know, if the horizontal axis is about the information, endless planes of information that are at our fingertips, the vertical axis is more about understanding knowledge at large, but particularly understanding ourselves. And so, you know, if we are stretched so thin, and I think most people can relate to that idea, the distraction, the loss of focus, the being pulled in all sorts of directions,
the overwhelm.
We tend to dissociate from that more vertical axis, dissociate from our own feeling life, from our emotional responses to things, and all of a sudden we're living in a more virtual world in a way that's totally disconnected from, you know, what we're used to talking about in Jungian psychology is the inner world. To me, when I sort of put on the psychological glasses and I go digging down into, well, what's the essential dynamic of the digital age, it seems to me that is dissociation, you know, or what in common parlance is often just called emotional detachment. And so that's a concern, because that becomes self-perpetuating, you know, if you're disconnected from the inner depths, then you're even more likely to want to sort of fill in your life at this level to find compensations for that lack of, you know, being rooted in something in yourself. So the book very much sort of turns that into that idea of dissociation into a pivot around which my discussion of post-humanism, being in the digital age, what the future portends, it all turns in my mind around this question of the dissociated.
Yeah, again, we've got a kind of a cycle there, cause and effect loop, where the technology draws us away from what is most deeply human about ourselves. And that in turn leaves a void that needs to be filled. Like, nature abhors a vacuum and the psyche abhors a vacuum. And so it just keeps kind of looping and perpetuating in this way. I love the idea you bring in of that being a very much a horizontal world, and losing a sense of the verticality. So the two poles of the verticality we could understand as on the lower end, our connection to nature and the kind of the animal body, instincts, ancestral memory, all those things. And on the upper end, let's say what Jung called the religious function, our seeking for God, our interest in the spiritual and...
Yeah, the need, the meaning.
Yeah, right. And you know, it's interesting because again, that void that's created is sometimes filled with the enthusiasm for technology. And the word enthusiasm, I think, is so appropriate here because it means to be filled with a godlike energy, and theos. And the technology kind of gives you a sense of having godlike powers, being able to create and manipulate the virtual world in any way you please. So again, it just seems like a kind of a Luciferian bargain.
It it does seem like that. And I think you've described that the sort of vicious cycle of life in the digital era quite well. It's not just online life. It's also the medicalization of psychological symptoms, the way we've convinced ourselves the brain is really just another machine. And if we kind of fiddle around with it, we can solve the psychological difficulties. But you use the word religious function, and that's another important concept here, because what Jung meant by that was close to what he saw as the integrative dimension of the psyche, the need for us to connect things. I mean, that's really how we make meaning. Like, how is my small life over here connected to the like larger scheme of things? So the religious function, it does pertain to the spirit, but I think even more so in Jung, it's about how the spiritual questions meet the deeper roots of the psyche, where image and instinct come together, if you will. So, if that dynamic is disrupted, it does leave a kind of hole in the personality, which I think, as you rightly describe, we then fill with outer things. And you know, there's been several books written over the years putting forth the thesis that the world of virtual reality and the kind of fantasy of transcending the body that we get in posthumanism, that this is a sort of displaced religiosity. And so, you know, I certainly tap into that stream of thinking and look at it in my own way. And the difficulty there is that it's something that goes on quite unconsciously. In other words, if you displace the religious instinct, as Jung called it, and you're not mindful of this need for meaning, and it all gets housed in the grand possibilities of technology and where they're going to take us, it means there's a kind of compulsive quality to that people don't understand what is fueling that. Why am I putting all the eggs into the basket of technological solutions? And Jung would just say, well, that's where contemporary religious life has gone in many respects. You know, that's where the God really resides, our own godlike power to change the course of creation is a quasi religious fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you point out that one of the things that got us to where we are, one of the contributing factors, is the post-Enlightenment scientific revolution. Again, science looking to answer the questions we have of life and our place in the universe, nature of the universe. So it becomes scientism, becomes its own form of religion that, you know, most of the kind of modern atheists that I've heard from are scientists. They're converts to that religion, or if you want to call it that. I think there's something about that. Like, it's answering a question, like a fundamental human question. And I think it's often happening unconsciously that these are really deeply human questions that we've always been asking, and we've sought for answers in different ways. And science is the kind of the latest thing to fill that void.
It's a really critical idea. You know, of course, science is tremendous and has expanded our knowledge and understanding and fueled innovation. But when it's the only way of looking at life, that's the problem of psychological one-sidedness. The imagination is left behind, the symbolic thinking, but go ahead.
Well, it never answers the question of why are we here? Mm-hmm. And what is our role other than to be, discoverers of the truth, the scientific truth or something. That doesn't seem very meaningful, actually. Well, who are we discovering it for? Just ourselves? So it never asks the fundamental question that religion and spirituality can answer, is the why. And so if that gets left unanswered, maybe the why turns into this kind of Promethean impulse to become godlike, to become creators, to create our own metaverse, our own virtual reality, our own virtual avatar in the virtual space. I'm just kind of thinking on my feet here, but mm-hmm. any response?
I think that's really on the right track in the sense that, you know, science so often comes with the fantasy of just doing away with certain aspects of human nature, particularly the non-rational or the irrational. And that's what I like about Jung. You know, Jung was a phenomenologist, not an idealist. He looked at the human psyche and said, well, people just have this proclivity to look for the whys, to look for a sense of meaning that's built in. And if you try to pretend that that's not there, it doesn't go away. It just gets displaced and projected into other things. And as you say, then science becomes scientism, and you've got all your eggs in the one basket. And if someone were just to say to me, well, what's the real problem of technology? I'd say, well, it's the all the eggs in one basket fantasy, because it disenfranchises other legitimate aspects of our being. And those things don't go away. As Jung says, the gods that we dismiss return as symptoms. And I think that's the real crux of the difficulty that we're living into. We seem to be living into an extreme form of one-sidedness, thinking that we can solve everything with technology and scientific thinking, and we're leaving a lot of things on the shelf that will, I think, turn around and bite us.
Mm. Yeah. When listening to prominent atheists like Dawkins or Hitchens, when pressed for, you know, well, science doesn't answer some of these big questions, you know, there's no real good explanation for the creation of the universe, for instance. It's like in science, you get one miracle, you get the Big Bang, it just kind of does away with that problem. But it's not a very good answer, actually. But when pressed, they'll often say, well, science will have the answer, it's just a matter of time. Mm-hmm. You know, there's such a kind of belief and faith in science to answer all the questions. And a lot of what drives that is, well, we just need to, as technology advances, the microscopes will get more refined and more powerful, and telescopes and all of that, and we'll be able to answer all the questions. It's a matter of the technology catching up to the questions or something. Like, there's a real faith in that.
Well, it what you're describing, I think, is one of the major displacements that goes on, which is the displacement of mystery. Mm-hmm. Mystery seems to me to be very closely related to a sense of soul, and you basically dismiss mystery with that kind of idea. The other implication I see relates to a term that Yuval Noah Harari brings in his treatment of where we're headed with technology, which is quite compelling. And he uses the term dataism, that what's at the core, and he calls that a religion. That's what's at the core of the digital age is the religion of dataism, which is the belief that everything really in the end comes down to data. Even our biology is just data. And you mentioned Dawkins, and I've got a quote from him in the book where he says it's, you know, this truth couldn't be any more apparent than if it was raining floppy disks. It was written a couple of decades ago. But I think that is one of the arguments that comes up when people say, well, we should, for example, pause in our development of AI, because the fantasy among a lot of technologists is if we stop the generation of information and data, if we somehow don't put everything into that, then we're not going to get to these answers that you're talking about. But again, it's a sort of absolutist idea of reality, that it's just data.
Right. Yeah. And the carrots they're dangling are things like, well, AI will help us solve the climate crisis. It'll help us solve death, you know, as if death needs a solution.
That's a very strong post-human fantasy, is getting beyond death and reaching some sort of immortality.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems to me that the scientism, there's a lot of hubris there, you know, that we'll find the answers. It's just a matter of, give us enough time, we'll answer everything. And it seems to me to come from an inability to tolerate the mystery, an inability to tolerate uncertainty. Like, it's a kind of defense against uncertainty, which I think a religious perspective, that's what it also does. It helps us to tolerate the great mystery by providing answers, which themselves are kind of mysterious as well, right? Like, what is the nature of God? Well, we can't even say, but just accept it, you know? And it's like, okay, it's like, it gives me a place to rest the, I don't know, the anxiety, I don't know, or a container to hold the anxiety or something.
Yeah, I think you're describing what I keep coming back to in the book as this vertical axis, you know. And Hillman used to love to quote Heraclitus, I think it was, about the unfathomable nature of the soul, so that if you really make room for that vertical axis, you're also making room for the unknowing, for the uncertainty, for the mystery. But then that becomes a place that you're comfortable with, and I don't think you're then as compulsively pushed into the horizontal to look for answers, to kind of fill in the gap that's left by that lack of verticality and self-understanding. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something about that image of the cross, like that the vertical pole is rooted in the earth, and that provides a kind of stability. Without that, the horizontal is maybe always in a state of imbalance. And so we get the you know, to bring up Heraclitus again, the enantiodromia, the counterbalancing that's continual, you know, like one of the counterbalances to this impulse, like Jung pointed out, is the rise in interest in non-Christian spiritualities, in the occult, in depth psychology itself. At the same time, like we see that those things are still proliferating in the world. People have more interest in astrology and the occult and Eastern spirituality and indigenous spiritualities and things like that. But at the same time, we've also seemed to have a rise in conversion to orthodoxy, which is becoming very popular in the online space, you know, with people like Jordan Peterson and others really promoting this. It's like, okay, they're addressing the same concerns that you are in the book, but their answer is what I feel is a kind of regression into a return to the old belief systems that that were the best answer we have to these kind of existential problems. Mm-hmm. Do you agree that it's a kind of regression and that, again, it's a response to going into the unknown, the uncertainty of what is the right cosmovision for our time?
Well, it's a bit of a delicate balancing act. You know, I talk a lot in the book about how scientism in our time is bookended by religious fundamentalism. Both are somewhat similar in that they try to literalize or concretize their areas of concern. And it does seem as though we are in a culture war that bounces backwards and forwards between those. I haven't really kept track of Jordan Peterson. When he first became a phenomenon, I sort of followed him a little bit. But I think that there is then a hunger that people want principles. They want kind of clear points of view. The anchoring in the past, I think, is what is key. And so how can you make room for tradition without it becoming traditionalism? I think that's the part of the balancing act. How can we respect the past? Because I often say to my students, the collective unconscious in Jung is really what the indigenous mean by the world of the ancestors. So it is the world of the past. And Jung's psychology at the end of the day says, well, you can't really have meaning or a sense of soul unless you've connected with that. But the technosphere is dominated by futurism. You know, you mentioned Prometheus a little while back. Well, that Prometheus means forethought. So to be Promethean is to always be looking ahead. And Jung wrote that wonderful paper that I make quite a bit of in the book, The Spiritual Problem of Modern Man. It's in Collected Works 10, I believe. And he makes that point that we live in the Promethean age, and it means that we've turned our back to the past. Then these traditionalisms, these fundamentalisms kind of come up then in compensation. That's a problem. But he also in that same essay points out what you said a few moments ago, which is it's also a time where many people are searching and they're turning to Eastern philosophy or they're turning to various mysticisms and occult systems because they're hungry, you know. And so he makes the point that it's a dangerous time, but it's also a time of opportunity because it could actually lead eventually to a renewal of that verticality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the way I've been thinking about it, like in response to seeing this kind of the neo-orthodoxy emerging among intellectuals in the West, is you know, I do see it as regression, and like I don't think we should throw out the disagreeable parts of our past, of our ancestry, because with that we're also throwing out our ancestors. You know, some of my ancestors were very devoted Christians, and it helped them get through incredibly difficult times. It helped kind of hold together these Mennonite communities that went through incredible hardship. So I can't throw it out, and I must reckon with it. And where I'm at these days is thinking that, okay, how to respect the traditions of the past, of my ancestors. One way to do it might be to kind of, what's the right word? I don't want to be offensive here, but to demote the Christian story to a myth. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't diminish its meaning and its importance, but it takes it out of the literal and puts it into the mythological. Just as previous belief systems and religions were kind of demoted to mythology. And we seem to be fine with that. When we talk about the Greeks, everyone accepts, well, these are myths. They weren't literally true. And there's an argument that says, well, the Greeks didn't even really believe them. They knew they were myths. I could probably argue with that. But I think maybe it's time for the Abrahamic religions to be put in that place of mythology, and like, let's move on out of literalism, because as you point out in the book, one thing that science has helped us to do and rationalism has helped us to do is to see that these stories aren't literally true. I mean, we just know too much now. So we'd have to be in some kind of self-denial to give ourselves fully over to a literal belief in these stories, which creates its own problems, right, of repression.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's astounding that here we are a quarter into the 21st century, and, you know, in the second half of the 20th century, there was, I think, the idea that reason would save us. But now, you know, what major conflict around the world doesn't, in a sense, have some sort of religious ideology buried within it? And the problem of not being able to see religion as myth means that we can't tolerate other belief systems. And I understand that faith is a very powerful thing, and that people need to be left to the to devote themselves to a particular tradition, but not at the expense of not seeing the value of you know, someone else's tradition. So I think that mythological way of thinking, if you will, belongs to this axis of verticality. It's belongs to how we make room for the collective unconscious, for the archetypal world. It's the realm of the non-rational, and yet we need stories. We, you know, it's very interesting to see the arc of Harari's thinking around this, because even though in his book Sapiens he talks all about the way where storied you know, humans have basically created civilizations out of stories, but he thinks it's time to do away with story, to do away with the pursuit of meaning. And of course, from my depth psychological point of view, I tend to think, well, we can't really do that. That's another one of those rational moves that's not going to work out, because it's just the nature of the psyche. We need to look for those things, but we've got to do it in a different way. And who knows, maybe the capacity to see through technologism to its underlying religiosity goes hand in hand with the ability to see that religion itself has a mythic or archetypal basis, that it would free our minds to imagine more deeply into many things.
It's a difficult one because, like in the Christian belief system, there's the idea that's fundamental to it that man's purpose is to reign over the earth. And so someone coming out of that belief system would see technology as just another means to do so. So you're in a kind of difficult bind there, depending on the belief system.
Yeah, one of the books about religion and technology that's particularly good is by, I think it's Richard, last name Noble, and it's simply called The Religion of Technology. And he points out kind of counterintuitively that many technologists are also strong Christians. And it's for the kind of reason that you just stated, that technology is in a way drawing us closer to God in our capacity to be able to, reign over the earth. And so in my book, the counter to that fantasy would be what I would call the co-creative point of view, where, yes, we have reached a godlike power in our relationship with technology, and we can't go back. But what will guide us in the use of that power? And I think it has to be the sort of feedback loops that occur when we turn towards psychological symptoms, either individually or collectively. You know, what is the we have the model for it. We've seen that the whole planet can respond to our activity and input, and I think we're struggling, but we're making our way into that paradigm shift of realizing we can't just do whatever we want. We have to respond to that pushback from the natural world. But can we do that psychologically? Can we wield this tremendous knowledge and power in conjunction with another source of wisdom? That would be the co-creative possibility. That would be perhaps even another kind of myth that we could live by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, again, this comes back to a disconnection from the soul. You did a great job in the epilogue of drawing out some distinctions between psyche and soul in the way that that you're using it, but I think also in the way that Jung used them, not always interchangeably. I always felt that psyche was pointing to something larger than soul, like you said, the ecology of mind, and I was thinking of it as psyche as the inner world myself, that extends into the outer world. And soul was more our individual way of experiencing that world, of engaging with it, soul being a kind of intermediary or a connective principle in a way. Mm-hmm. And if we're connected to our soul, we're connected to all these other values. Can you talk a little bit about how, like, what you associate with soul, like it as a kind of organ of perception?
Yeah. Well, it's I take a lot from Hillman's handling of the idea. But I think the umbrella notion would be that it's a qualitative term. It points to the feeling of depth, significance, meaning. It seems to have a timeless aspect to it. In other words, when we think about the soul that we carry through life, we think of that as having roots that go beyond our life, and also having values that will extend, you know, after we're gone. So soul, as Hillman points out, is really larger than life. People will readily give up their bodies to save their souls. That we carry this notion that there is something, this kind of qualitative field that we cultivate in life. That is certainly, yes, it's very personal, but it's beyond that as well. So it relates to all those things, and is also, when people think about a sense of soul, they think about what's most essential, you know.
Kind of deepest values of life.
Psyche's a little, by contrast, is a little more, what's the term? Well, certainly pertains to the psychological way of thinking and being, is, as you say, perhaps a little more expansive in relationship to the inner outer connection. We can talk about the psychodynamics and the compensatory relationship between conscious and unconscious, but that's all a bit more mechanical than this qualitative sense of having and being a soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you described psyche as it's kind of an abstract term, I guess, right? Like, mm-hmm. There's no pointing to the psyche, but so it's an abstract term that is pointing at the underlying structures and dynamics of our inner life, of mind and experience, and the soul maybe as the experiencer.
Well, the psyche is very pervasive if we think about it as a field of experience, but we can talk about the psyche more precisely when we do talk about these patterns and dynamics that, for example, Jung argued follow the psyche, whether it's the psyche of the individual or the psyche of a group. The psyche contains shadows. It contains these essential values the ancients called gods. It has this compensatory conscious unconscious side and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just struck me that maybe like psyche is a lot like the Tao. Mm-hmm. In a way. Mm-hmm. It's always it's always in flux. The past and the future are both present. It's always finding balance, compensating. And the soul can be in alignment with that or out of alignment with that, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I guess my point being that if we are connected to soul, we're going to have a different experience of the world and a different valuing of the world, mm-hmm. which will guide us in our choices and actions and behavior, which is like a kind of a bottom-up approach rather than the Skinner model of a top-down approach, like you work directly on changing the behaviors. And whether that has an effect on the soul or not, I don't know. But it just seems like two different ways of trying to be in harmony with the world.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to consider how we often talk about feeding the soul, or, you know, what is soul food? And part of what I try to champion in the book is the importance of culture and the cultural imagination, because I think that collectively, that's what feeds and sustains the soul, is the arts, the humanities, the literature, the things that help us relate to life in a soulful manner, that make room for the mysterious, and you know, that's one of the things you see even on television coming up in the conversations around AI, the threat that AI poses to culture. Because if, of course, we rely on it for writing our stories and our musics and even poetry and so forth, then where is that culture-making capacity going to go? Where is our discernment for what is of tremendous cultural vision and value? What's going to happen to that? So a lot of people sort of push aside the doomsday scenario of AI taking over and launching all the nukes, and come back to that very real threat. And I think we've already got a taste of that, to think about what, for example, the emphasis on STEM in education, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, like what is that doing to the imagination? And how is that going to end up impacting our sense of soul and our ability to make culture, which again I see as going hand in hand. And so that's the big fear I have in the book. Are we just simply creating a massive technocracy that will eviscerate the realm of culture and just turn us into sort of functionaries?
Yeah, what comes up for me when you speak about that is Hillman's idea, well, that he got from Keats, that having a soul is not a given. Soul is something that has to be grown or made. Like the soul has to be fed in order to grow and become, I think, more substantial. The way I think of it is, it's like when we're talking about a soulful person, it's because they've grown the soul and it's filling out more of their personality. So I feel it very tangibly that way. And, you know, I volunteer at the local high school with a youth music program. Mm. And one of the reasons why I did that, because music is really important to me, it was important to me when I was young. And so it's kind of a way to give back. But also because their music programs were canceled and the band room sits empty.
Wow.
And yeah. And, you know, meanwhile, there's a full computer lab with all the latest CAD design software and 3D printing modules and things like that. And yet this beautiful band room sits empty most of the time. And so I wonder, like, if we're not feeding the souls of the young, what kind of void is that leaving? And of course, we see the effects. You have to be in incredible denial not to see the correlations between, the mental health and the like what you call the digital natives, the kids who have grown up with this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's a very dire circumstance, because if we don't do something to feed their souls now, they might not get to a place where, there's a opportunity to remedy that, you know, because of the high suicide rates.
Right. Well, you know, part of the soul, as you know, that Hillman underscores, is the realm of our wounds and suffering, because they're the things that also take us into our depths. And I think you could say that the soul needs cradles, and those cradles are made in the cultural imagination. So, you know, if one's depressed or, you know, suffering a loss, or you turn to music, you look for those images in the poets, the songwriters, because then you feel your soul is somehow held. And to me, it's part of the suffering of the digital native is direct because of the distortion, the algorithmic distortions that are going on in social media. A term I haven't used yet is social engineering. And that would be part of becoming more conscious as we move ahead, is realizing the degree to which tech companies are engaged in social engineering without being conscious of it or putting enough awareness in it. But the other side of it is that I think young people lack stories. They lack images that provide, you know, because life, you know, if you're going to live in any full and open way, you are going to get hit with these losses, with these wounds, with these personality problems, with these massive questions. And how do you hold those things if you don't have that fabric of the cultural imagination? And
this was an excerpt of a longer conversation. If you'd like to listen to the full episode and support the podcast, consider becoming part of the pack over at patreon.com/howlinthewilderness. Thanks.